KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Benicia.
Sunset District.
I live in Lakeside.
The Western Addition.
Diamond Heights.
Coming up, we'll take a ride on a bus that's used for more than transportation.
If you have to ride this bus, you've got to be prepared to defend what you've got and sleep with the one eye open.
Then an Oakland educator writes a book that follows her unaccompanied migrant students.
They knew that a lot of what was happening to them and to their fellow students was deeply unfair, and they wanted people to know about it.
And we'll hear about an annual concert celebrating Bay Area women who make music.
The second year, I thought, okay, let's bring the little girls and teenagers in. Let's pair them with the pros. The press got behind it. It completely sold out.
Sing it, sister. Cross Currents is coming up. Santa Clara County has the seventh biggest population of unhoused people in the United States. And it's been a problem for many years. The people affected have been trying to find their own solutions, doing things like camping along the creek or spending the night on the 22 bus line. It's the county's only overnight bus service, and it's been used as a makeshift homeless shelter for more than a decade. But this year, the Transportation Authority is considering shutting down the all-night service. KALW's Isabel Angel took a ride on the 22 a couple of years ago, and she met with some of the people who called it home.
I've heard there's a nickname for the bus. Do you know what it is?
Yeah, there's the Motel 22 or Hotel 22. That's the big one I've heard. I call it home.
That's Michael Garber. I'm riding the 22 bus with him and his wife.
My name is Elizabeth Garber. I've been homeless for about 8 months so far, riding the bus 22 as many times at night as we have money for.
Right now, we're on the bus somewhere between East San Jose and Palo Alto. It's 2:30 a.m. and it's raining. Some people are covered in blankets, settled way down in their seats. Others are surrounded by bags. During the day, this is a regular city bus. But at night, it makes an unofficial transformation from bus 22 to hotel 22. Dozens of people like the Garbers pay the $2 fare and use this bus as a shelter for the length of its route, a two-hour ride. So that means once every 2 hours, everybody has to get off and stand out in the cold to wait for the next bus. Back aboard, I meet Jose Diaz. He's spending tonight on Hotel 22.
I'm a homeless guy, and this is
Elizabeth from Campbell.
We just met. I guess we're going to hang out. She says she's hanging out with me. I don't know why, but she doesn't even know me.
Diaz has been homeless for 14 years. He usually sleeps outside. The reason he's on the bus tonight?
To get out of the rain.
And nowhere else to go.
Up ahead, we come to a stop.
We can get up and go to Denny's. I got a little bit of money. We'll get some coffee.
Actually,
there's Denny's right there. Hey, pull the thing. We're getting out.
No, Denny's. Wait,
wanna go get some coffee?
Yeah, let's get some coffee.
Staying on the Hotel 22 means it's the middle of the night, the lights are on, you're surrounded by 30 or so people you hardly know, and it's loud. There's a chatter rising above the sounds of the bus, mostly from people heading home after a night out. There's also a drunk man talking loudly to whoever will listen, and a woman sharing her history of drug abuse with her seatmate. Not your typical bedroom.
And, you know, like, your stuff's not secure, you're not secure. It's just, that's like the greatest hardship of it all. It's just the constant, almost paranoid sense of vigilance you have to maintain. You know, if you have to ride this bus, you know, you've got to be prepared to, you know, defend what you've got and just really, you know, sleep with the one eye open.
Garber says he only sleeps about 3 hours a night, and that takes a toll.
Oh yeah, I've missed interviews because I fall asleep on the bus in the morning. I miss my stop. I wake up. I've missed court dates, and so yeah, I don't know how many opportunities I've lost because of it. You know.
Garber had a job working for Walmart, but they didn't keep him on. He and his wife Elizabeth used to live with her mother, but they couldn't contribute enough rent after he lost his job.
We ended up on the street. And we've been doing that ever since.
They've tried to sign up for affordable housing, but nothing has panned out. Finding housing is competitive for everyone. Landlords are much more likely to go for someone with a stable job history over a person coming off the streets or a bus. We're getting close to the last stop. I head to the front to talk to the driver. I ask her what she thinks of driving people who have nowhere else to go.
You know, everybody who gets on, they're getting on for a reason. Either they're going to sleep from, you know, end to end, or they're going home, or they're going to work, or it doesn't bother me. I just, you know, do my job.
So are we coming up to the end right now?
Yes. And then
we pull into the Palo Alto Transit Center, the end of the line. It's about 3:30 in the morning. A guard steps on. Everybody files off, some more willingly than others. Then they cross to the other side of the terminal and wait for the next bus. It's raining tonight, but summer's coming, and many of the people I talked to said they'll start sleeping outside instead of on the bus. In Palo Alto, I'm Isabel Angel for Cross Currents.
KALW's Angela Johnston helped produce that report. The VTA's proposal to shut down all night services is being met with protests. Find out more at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Lauren Markham is an immigration reporter who was covering the stories of unaccompanied children at the southern border in 2012. At the same time, Lauren is also a student program manager at Oakland Unified School District, working with refugee kids at Oakland International High School, where there's a large number of undocumented students. In her book, The Faraway Brothers, she follows the story of her students, the Flores brothers, on their journey from El Salvador to Oakland. She explores how they're navigating the legal system, immigration laws, and just being in a new country. I chatted with Lauren Markham, and she says it all started with the first article she wrote back in 2013 about migrant children stuck at the border.
I wrote another article that came out in 2014, and right when that article was about to come to press, a coworker walked into my office and said, hey,
back in Oakland International,
yeah, in my office at the school, and said, it's my friend Mr. David, a math teacher, and he came in and said, hey, we really need to do something about all of these young people at our school who have court dates. You know, all these kids have deportation dates coming up, and none of them have lawyers, and I don't understand much about what's going on, but something's up and they need support. And he's like, my job is to go teach math, so I'm going to go do that. And your job is to coordinate community programs. So can you figure this out? He sort of bell rang. He goes off to his class. And I was sort of sitting there dumbfounded because while I had been researching this issue all around the country, a number of these young people who were unaccompanied minors had showed up and enrolled at our school. And of course, in the education system, we don't or we should not ask what folks' immigration status is. So we weren't aware. We just knew where they'd come from. We knew a lot about their identities as young people.
But we didn't ask questions about that.
And so it turned out that we had 40 students that spring of 2014. January, February, there were about 40 who were unaccompanied minors. By the end of the year, there were 60. By September, there were 90. And now there are over 130 out of a school of 400.
In your work, you know, after you did all that reporting, you came back kind of to the job of things. At what point then did you say, I want to do something more, which is, you know, write a book about this?
Yeah.
And how did you pick the Flores brothers to tell the stories?
It's, you know, the story of their kind of upbringing in El Salvador, these young men who kind of are born in the wake of the Civil War and come of age in tandem with the rise of the gangs, which is very much like the gang issue in El Salvador is pretty inextricably linked to what happened during the Civil War and the kind of trauma and violence of that era and destruction of that era. So these young men kind of come of age, and they actually have a really nice childhood. They're living in a very poor context, but they describe their childhood pretty idyllically in a way. You know, they're outside a lot, and a really loving family. As they're growing up, right as they're becoming kind of preteens, teens, the gangs kind of start to move into town and kind of get a more and more of a stranglehold on local happenings in the community. The older twin, 12 minutes older, gets on the wrong side of the wrong guy from town, who's actually his uncle. And so the young man, Ernesto, the older twin, he kind of gets into a little misunderstanding and kind of a scuffle with the uncle. And the uncle is convinced that he's done something bad. And so he puts a hit out on him. And they find this out and they sort of try to work it out, but it's not workoutable. So the gangs are going to be after this kid. He leaves the country. And then they realize that because these young men are identical twins, that twin number two is actually quite at risk as well. So twin number two follows him. So they have these sort of separate journeys leaving El Salvador, and they meet up in Mexico City. And on the way, both of them have a really deeply, separately traumatic experience. One witnesses, I mean, without giving too much away, one is beaten and kidnapped and witnesses a pretty horrific rape. And the other one witnesses something incredibly horrific as well, actually up on the border with the United States.
They do end up in Oakland. In kind of safety, right?
Yes.
They get to safety. They find a program. They find a school. Yeah.
And they're with their older brother.
Yeah. Right. And they come here to their older brother. And now you're telling their story.
Yeah.
What do they say they want you to tell about their story?
Finding a lawyer for them was a huge stress. And they wanted people to understand how hard that is. You know, in the United States, in the criminal system, if someone cannot afford a lawyer, the government provides one. But that's not true in the immigration system. So even though we know that you're much, 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 like five times more likely to win your immigration case, lawyers are not provided, and not even to children. So I've seen little kids. I mean, I was in the San Francisco Immigration Court about a year ago, and there was a five-year-old kid who had to walk up by himself in front of the judge, you know? So the little boy comes up. So there's an advocate of the day who's not their attorney, but the advocate kind of like, so the advocates of the day in the San Francisco court can't take on the case because they don't have the capacity, but they are kind of there to make sure everything's kind of going okay. So the advocate kind of shoos the little boy up to the front. Little boy's sitting there, and then the judge says, well, has someone accompanied this young man? And the translator translates, and the woman in the back raises her hand and said, yeah, I'm his stepmother. And so she walks up through the pews, and he said, okay, well, you can come sit with this little boy because I just really want to make sure everyone feels comfortable in this court, and I don't want a young man of this age by himself without anybody if there's someone here who can support him. I know he'll feel much more comfortable. And I found myself actually doing what your face is doing. Like, oh my gosh, that's, you know, I don't want to project what your face is saying, but I found myself being like, that is so sweet and so kind. And then I found myself being like, wait, what? This is like the most basic thing, right? And just having been in that courtroom for only half an hour, how much my mindset had already changed towards seeing what was just like an act of basic human decency as this like act of great mercy, you know?
Do you feel that's happening to us,
yes,
though, as a society?
Doesn't like, it feel like that?
It does.
Yeah.
Like we're normalizing,
yes,
things that should not be normalized.
Exactly. Exactly. And how quickly, frankly, we do that. You know, if that could happen to me in an hour, having like, you know, studied all of the, like, and partially maybe the fact that I was more studied on it made me understand how much his action was maybe an outlier. But again, that shouldn't be, I appreciate that move, but he doesn't deserve the Nobel Peace Prize, you know, for that. And I think we're absolutely doing that as a society when we're hearing these stories and seeing these stories of brutality. I mean, that's happening with police brutality. That's happening with brutality against immigrants. That's happening here in the Bay Area. How many of us have stepped past people's homes living on the street, right? Like, this is what happens with injustice. And so I guess back to your original question of, like, I don't know that the twins put it quite this way, but I think that they really felt like they wanted people to understand their stories because they knew that a lot of what was happening to them and to their fellow students and friends was deeply unfair and scary and not okay. And they wanted people to know about it.
How are they now?
They're good. They're good. They're definitely rooting. And I mean, they're still, I think it will be a long process of rooting, but I think they feel more rooted and more comfortable than ever. They have more steady jobs, which is good. They've sort of developed a deeper and more connected community here in the Bay Area. So I think they definitely, I don't think this is quite home yet, but it's not this sort of foreign, scary place that it was for a while for them.
Lauren Markham is author of The Far Away Brothers. You can catch her at this year's Bay Area Book Festival. Find out when she's on the schedule at KELW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Singer Rhonda Benin has toured professionally for over 25 years. She's a member of the Grammy-nominated Linda Tillery and the Cultural Heritage Choir, and she's a soloist. Rhonda's experience as a woman in music led her to create the annual Women's History Month concert Just Like a Woman 6 years ago. The show features a cast of powerful female singers from the Bay Area along with Rhonda, and it happens to be this weekend in Berkeley. Rhonda Benin came to KLW Studios last year and talked to Jen Chien about why this show is so important to her.
Did you grow up singing?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Did you always see yourself going into music, or was it more of a hobby or more of?
I never saw myself going into it. It was just something that I always could do.
So how did you end up choosing the path?
I got a job at CBS Television in Los Angeles. Because I ran the mail at CBS, I knew everything that was going on in that studio. So I got a wind of an audition for an artist that was on Casablanca Records. I took two more girls that could sing that I knew that worked at the studio, and we went to the audition just as a fluke, and we got the job.
It sounds like a movie.
Yeah, my whole life's been a movie. I quit my job at CBS. I decided that I'd just ride it out and see what happens.
And so when did you come to the Bay Area?
I came here in 1989. Mm-hmm. The two cities are very different. L.A. is more Hollywood, more established artists. Here, a lot of live music. Well, there was a lot of live music in the 80s and 90s. So it changed my view.
Mm. And you decided to stay here?
Yeah. In 2 weeks, I knew I should stay here.
Wow. My blues away. So tell me about your concert, Just Like a Woman. Where did the idea for this annual concert come from?
I was watching a Motown or Stax Records review, and they had all these various acts coming on one behind the other, like Sam and Dave, Rufus Thomas, Carla Thomas, Eddie Floyd. So I thought, okay, what if I put together a bunch of headliners? They do two or three songs each at one ticket price, and let's see how this thing goes. I didn't have a dime. I called four other singers. I said, let's put a band together. Let's do it. So we did it. On a Wednesday night, it was half full. I didn't make a penny, but it was good. So the second year, I thought, okay, I'll do it again. The second year, I thought, okay, let's bring the little girls and teenagers in. Let's pair them with the pros. Give them an opportunity to hit a big stage. They get paid just like the pros. Let's do that. The press got behind it. It completely sold out. So I was like, whoa, okay, this thing is turning into something. The third year, I started seeing people repeating coming back, but they were bringing more of their family members. So
they're making it a thing.
Yeah, so it's beginning to be a thing where the grandmother, the aunts, the mama, and the children and the grandchildren are all coming in a group. And so at the end of the show, I'll go outside and kind of position myself where nobody can really see me. And I'm listening to people walk past me singing.
You're doing market research.
And right? Laughing and skipping to their car. And I thought, okay, we got something here.
That must have felt good to see how it made people feel.
Yeah.
So
that's how this show started. Women write music. Women play instruments. Women sing.
Oh, and as you've shown, women also produce and figure out how to get it done.
Yes. It's so hard to call if people are going to come.
What kind of argument would you make for the power and the importance of a live musical experience?
I think to be in the place. I've been into in some situations where, oh, thank God I was there, because the magic just came out of nowhere.
Do you have a particular memory like that that you want to share?
I was coming from a gig, and I stopped at the 57th Street Gallery, which is no more. And it was the drummer James Levi's birthday. So I thought, okay, I'll just run in here on my way home. And it was packed, and I was in the back, and there were horn players in the back. And I heard them back there playing, and I looked, and I saw, and I waved. The horn players came out, and they started playing a line of, "You're Still a Young Man." And the real
Tower of Power.
Yeah, and the real singer.
Rick Stevens.
Rick Stevens, who had been in prison all those years for murder, who had just gotten out of prison. And he came up, and he sang, "You're Still a Young Man." And the room went up in complete smoke. Everybody in that room sang every part along with him. It was one of those times where it was like, whoa, this is the best thing I've ever seen.
I'm getting chills just hearing about it. That
pretty,
sounds amazing.
Chilling. Yeah, it was pretty, it was something. So those kind of moments.
So people get out to live shows.
Yeah.
Because you never know.
Yeah, you never know.
That was singer Rhonda Benin, and Rhonda's show, Just Like a Woman, is this Saturday at the Freight and Salvage in Berkeley. Find all the details at klw.org. And if you haven't already subscribed to the Cross Currents podcast, you want to do that. You may be missing some juicy things. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Down a crowded avenue. This music is by Half Stack from Oakland. They're playing at Eli's Mile High Club tomorrow night. The Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Joanne DeLuna, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega-Welch, True Quinn, Lisa Wang, and Eli Wertschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.